This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. To create your own space, visit squarespace.com and save 10% by using offer code TREK8. And also by TrekFan. It's not just a fan club, it's an adventure. You'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. Don't miss out. Help move us toward the Star Trek future by visiting TrekFan.org. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit Trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 109, Set Phasers to Rock. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Daniel Prue. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the Into Darkness Honest trailer, the Unification Blu-ray, Michael Dorn's Swallow Your Bliss Indiegogo campaign, and an update on the We Love Fine t-shirt design contest. Then in the feature, we're joined by Drew Stewart and Charlene Schmidt to discuss the TOS episode, The Devil in the Dark. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Daniel. It's great to have you back with me for the first time in a while. How have things been going since your last time here on the Ready Room?
Oh, things have been going pretty well. I moved out of my apartment, kind of in a transition period now. So, you know, moving sucks, I think, always for everybody. I don't know anybody that enjoys that. But, you know,
no.
I'm here in a temporary place. And yeah, I'm excited to be back on the Ready Room and talk some Star Trek.
Great. Yeah, I'm glad you're here. We missed having you on the show. Well, let's just jump on into our Star Trek news. Well, I guess first thing I want to share with everyone is that Star Trek Into Darkness has opened in Japan. Yes, it has. It finally opened on Friday, believe it or not. And so tomorrow I'm going to go and see it in IMAX. And finally, I'll get to see it on a really big screen. You know, when I did the screening at Paramount, it was a fairly small screen because it's their screening room in Tokyo. And so this time I'm going to get to see it, you know, life size, really big. And I'm looking forward to that. And my wife's going to go with me, which will be nice. We always see the movies in the theaters together. She likes Star Trek, but she's not a Trekkie per se. And my son's going to be seeing it. So getting the kids into Star Trek finally, maybe.
So this will be your second time with Into Darkness, right?
The second time around, yeah.
Yeah, I just got done, I think yesterday, watching it for the second time. And it'll be interesting. Let me know what you think, because the second time for me really kind of cemented the way I felt about it. But I won't say now, but let me know what you think when you see him.
That's why I have not written a full-on in-depth review of the movie yet. I've just talked about my thoughts here and there on the shows. And I wrote a capsule review, which you can read on my website, personal website, if you want, which I wrote for a magazine here in Japan. And in that review, I'm not allowed by Paramount to reveal the actual identity of John Harrison or, you know, really spoil the movie. But I wanted to wait until I could see the movie again before I wrote a full-on review because, you know, I mean, I have strong opinions about it based on the first viewing. But I do feel like I need to watch it at least one more time, maybe two more times, to let all of that settle in before I put it all down on a virtual paper.
Yeah. Like I said, I just got done watching it. And it definitely, because I was kind of on the fence about it in a few ways. I mean, I enjoyed it overall, but it doesn't have to get into that. But it'll definitely, you know, let you know where you stand with it the second time, at least in my experience.
Right. Well, you know, we have an item on our news today, and we were going to do it a little bit later, but this seems like the perfect time to talk about it. And this is that Star Trek Into Darkness Honest trailer that's been circulating this week, made by Screen Junkies. And this I thought was really hilarious. And I thought it was pretty much spot on, actually. Now, I'm not as critical of the film as a lot of Star Trek fans are, but I have to say, I think I agree with pretty much 100% of what was said in this trailer. What did you think about it?
Oh, I absolutely love it. If you're not subscribed to Screen Junkies, you should, because all of these honest trailers are gold. And even the 2009 Star Trek one was fantastic. And I love that movie. And every single thing that it pointed out, I was like, yeah, that's true. I mean, and they do it with such, you know, fun flair, pizzazz. Yeah. It's really funny. And I love that at the end of it, it was the How It Should Have Ended guys who kind of who ended the honest trailer for Into Darkness. It was really good.
What was your favorite thing that they pointed out in the trailer?
Oh, man. I have to say, I don't know why I cracked up, because of the big controversy, the big hoopla with the Carol Marcus and the half naked scene. I loved that they changed their one reason to two reasons, and they kind of zoomed in on it.
They zoomed
hilarious.
In on it. Yeah. Yeah, I think there was a bit too much hoopla about that scene personally as well.
But I agree.
Yeah, that was in there. I think my favorite thing was the beginning, where they say, the sequel to the movie that's a sequel to the original movie that's a sequel. Because it's perfect. And all the bits about JJ saying that, okay, it's not Khan, it's not going to be a rehash of The Wrath of Khan. And if you just go watch the movie, you can get a feeling like maybe it wasn't quite as much a rehash. But when they put it the way they do in here, and they pull all the scenes out, and you're like, but then there's this, and there's this, and of course, this, the famous scream scene, which, you know, it shouldn't be in the movie. Yep. And then they say, not only is he stealing from The Wrath of Khan, he's also stealing everything you loved about his first movie, like this, and this.
and then about halfway it's through hilarious. The trailer, you get the obvious, but still funny, even more lens flares. Right. And you don't even realize, like, at least I don't even realize how many there are until they point it out in the trailer, and they just show them back to back to back. And you're like, wow, that is actually a lot.
It's a good point, because there was a trailer. I saw something for a new JJ movie that's coming out the other day. And they said, believe it or not, there are no lens flares in the movie. And I was thinking, I don't remember, were there that many lens flares in Into Darkness? Because I didn't really notice them that much when I'm watching the movie. But yeah, I guess there are. And there's the one they show with Carol Marcus there, and you can barely see her face because there's this giant lens flare. But I think it's fun to joke about those things, but I really don't think they detract from the movie that much. I really didn't even pay attention to them when I was watching
Into Darkness. Yeah, I don't even notice. That scene you just mentioned where when you see that one or 2 second clip in that trailer, you're like, wow, she's so washed out. You can't see the expression. She's looks like she's kind of crying. You can't tell. When I just watched the movie the other day, I didn't even notice it. So I you know, it's weird.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's an artistic thing. And, you know, I mean, he does them in camera. It's his style. It doesn't bother me really, but this trailer is great. If you haven't seen it, you need to go watch it. I think the communication with Spock, because it was one of the problems that I had with the movie, is that I don't think they should have communicated with Prime Spock and had him help them with a solution. But I like here that they say Prime Spock is just a FaceTime call away. And then they go through the whole list of him, you know, just a checklist of things. Make sure you do this and this and this and this. Oh, and when you go to 1930, you need to kill Kirk's girlfriend, but also pick up a couple of whales, because that'll save you time later.
No, don't kill the Gorn. It's just a trick.
That's right.
Yeah, it's good.
We covered the Gorn, right? Yes, it's right here.
They even mentioned the Borg, which was a little out of place, but it was kind of, yeah, obviously it's just a joke trailer, but it was funny.
Yeah. So it's great. And no matter how you feel about the film, I think it's important in Star Trek that we're able to laugh about these things too, because it's wonderful to be really, really serious about Star Trek and to be serious about the topics that it's covering, and to be serious and really upset when you feel that something's been done wrong to the franchise you love. But it's also important to laugh and have fun about Star Trek as well. They do a great job of it here.
Absolutely.
So we'll put a link to that in the show notes if you haven't seen it already, although chances are you probably have seen it by now. Another thing, while we're talking about Spock, Daniel, is the Unification Blu-ray is available for pre-order. And we've talked on here before they even announced it, whether we thought they would do it or not. And we talked about two-parters that we would like to see more than others. And I think we agree that Unification would make a good Blu-ray. How do you feel about this feature length process that's going on?
I love Unification. Absolutely love it. It has every element of Star Trek that I absolutely love. Spock is one of my all-time favorite characters. The Romulans are my favorite bad guys. And Picard is my favorite captain. And Data's there, who is my favorite Next Generation character. Unification is kind of the pinnacle of TNG for me. And I couldn't be more excited about it. I feel like they actually made this for me. So I'm really excited about it.
You really feel that way when the title screen comes up and it says, "For Daniel Prue." And then it fades and then awesome. They go into the episode. Yeah.
Seriously. Absolutely. I mean, could you not? I love Unification. It's fantastic.
Yeah. This is one they had to do as a feature length. And I'm kind of assuming now that they're going to do all the two-parters. I'm still kind of wondering about something like Gambit, if they're going to bother putting that out on Blu-ray, because it's not really a great episode in the first place. Right. Are they going to do all the two-parters?
I would be okay if they skipped Gambit. I would actually be really okay if they skipped Time's Arrow, too. I don't really care for those episodes, but Unification's great, so...
Yeah. I kind of like Time's Arrow. I'm not a big fan of Descent. I felt like that was where they just didn't have a good idea for the sixth season cliffhanger, and it just, I don't know, using Lore and Borg and everything they did was kind of weak.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah. After Unification, they kind of went downhill with the two-parters a lot.
One thing I wanted to ask you is that with this trend of doing two-parters as feature-length Blu-ray releases, when they move on to Deep Space Nine, what would you think about the idea of doing something like the Circle Trilogy that started season two, where you've actually got a three-parter of putting that together as just one long story on Blu-ray?
That would be awesome. They totally should do that. I think the problem that they'll run into, towards the end, how will they handle the end arc? Would they put all nine of those episodes on one Blu-ray?
I don't think they would do that.
Right. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't cost them any more money just to put three episodes on a disc than to do two episodes. So I don't see any reason why they wouldn't do it, right?
Yeah. I mean, they would have to do a little bit of work to bring it together into one continuous story,
right.
So it's not like, but it's not a lot of work, right? Because all the footage is there. You just have to kind of, pull that together. So I think it would be interesting. Yeah. Like, the seventh season arc at the end, of course, you're not going to make just one giant story out of that because it kind of is anyway. Yeah. But the Circle Trilogy is at a time before they got into those types of arcs in DS9. So it's kind of unique that it really is a three-parter. It's the first three-parter in Star Trek. And, that Past Tense, for example, could be a good one to do on DS9 as a feature-length Blu-ray. So, we'll see.
I kind of feel like they won't.
Probably not. Yeah.
I mean, I love Deep Space Nine, but it doesn't have near the viewers that TNG does. TNG, people are walking through Best Buy and they see these collections and like, wow, I saw that 10 years ago, man, this will bring me back. And just, average people will pick that up. Not a Star Trek fan. Deep Space Nine isn't going to have that same kind of draw. So I don't think they're going to put the time and the effort and the money into those kinds of things. I don't think, unfortunately, but.
You're probably right. I think it depends on who works on the project, because I do think that the team behind DS9, if there's any way they could push the studio, like, let us do this. You let us do our own thing when we were on the air, and we produced some of the most brilliant storytelling in the history of television. Let us do this. It's not going to take that much more work. And the fans who love the series, the Niners, are really, really going to appreciate this. And you're going to make a lot of people really happy if you do it. So maybe they will. To your point about people walking through and seeing the TNG stuff, that makes me wonder about Voyager fans, because I don't know if Voyager really had a larger audience than DS9 did, but I think that Voyager has maybe a broader general audience than DS9 does, in the way that TNG has a broader general audience. I wonder if they will do some of the Voyager two-parters as Blu-rays.
Yeah, and I mean, even I know that the Enterprise Blu-rays they're kind of treating them separately than the TNG Blu-rays and stuff. But I don't think once we get into season 4 that they're going to start splitting those arcs into separate DVDs either. I don't think so. As much as a disappointment as it might be to us fans, I imagine it'll most likely be just TNG that get these special one-off discs and stuff like that.
Yeah. You're probably right, because TNG by far has the largest audience of all the series. Some people might argue that TOS is up there as well, but I don't know. I really think TNG...
Yeah, I don't think so.
That's the series that really captured the general public more than any other, especially people who are of the age right now to be going out and just picking these things up as they walk by them in Best Buy and such. So,
yep.
So we'll see, but that's out. We'll put a link in the show notes if you want to go check it out and pre-order. It'll drop alongside TNG Season 5, which is also available for pre-order, although the current price I've been seeing is $90.99, so that'll definitely drop a lot by the time it's released. I usually pre-order a little bit closer to release once it gets down into the 70s myself.
Yeah, Season 5. I can't wait.
Yeah. So, Daniel, another story. This is just a quick thing here, an update for everyone. Quite a while back on the Ready Room, we told you about the We Love Fine Star Trek Design Contest for t-shirt designs. And this is the one where LeVar Burton is on the judging panel. And a lot of people have entered. They have received 400 entries, and voting is now open. So if you want to vote for your favorite t-shirt, you can go over and check it out. Voting ends September 15th, so you have a couple of weeks to do that. You will be rating the shirts on a scale of 1 to 5, and the winning designs will be available for purchase after the contest. So that's where that contest stands right now. I haven't had a chance myself to go over and look yet, Daniel. Imagine like your perfect Star Trek t-shirt. If you go over there and you find something that's what you consider the perfect t-shirt, what might that be?
Honestly, probably a Cetacean Ops t-shirt, you know, like a really cool design, like, and you know, maybe a picture of Commander Flipper in the background. It would be great. I mean, he doesn't get enough love. He is an underappreciated character, and I really think that we need to give him some more love.
Perfect. Yeah, that's great. Mine would probably be something that has Leffler's Laws printed on them. You could do a whole collection of those.
That would be cool. I would pick that up for sure. You know what else might be a good idea? You probably have to have some copyright issues here, but maybe on the front of the t-shirt, you see Peppy from Star Fox. Right on the front it says, "To do a barrel, press Z or R twice." And then on the back, you got Geordi doing the barrel. Do a barrel roll. The barrel roll, press Z or R twice. That'd be great.
That's perfect, because that captures all of geekdom, right? You get the Star Trek fans.
That's right.
And you get the video game fans with Star Fox.
Yep.
Awesome.
Yep.
I like
Absolutely.
That. Well, go check it out, everyone. We'll put a link in the show notes. You can go over and vote on, I believe you can vote on StarTrek.com. At least you can get more information there and help pick the winners of this contest. Again, voting ends on September 15th. One more item in news today, Daniel. Michael Dorn has an Indiegogo campaign going for a new project of his. What can you tell us about that project?
It's called Swallow Your Bliss. Now, apparently he's a busy guy because he's trying to get this Captain Worf show off the ground. He's got this new Indiegogo show. But it's a... It's called Swallow Your Bliss, and it's about a cooking show, which is a little strange, I guess. Not what I would expect out of Michael Dorn, anyways. But looking at some of the people involved, it's quite a who's who of funny people in TV right now. You've got some people from Community, from Workaholics, even from Reba. So, you know, it's the cream of the crop.
I think if they do make this a success, if they get it off the ground and they do it, they need to have Star Trek actors come on as guests. As it's a cooking show, I would love to see Sisko and Riker come on. So you've got Avery Brooks, you've got Jonathan Frakes. They both like to cook. They both like to sing little ditties while they cook. I think it could be great. And of course, you could have Ethan Phillips on there as the master chef.
Yeah, well, of course. So we could... That brings up a question. If Riker and Sisko come on, is Sisko going to play the keys and Riker's going to pull out his bone and they're just going to jazz together?
Yeah, and then Garrett Wong can come on, you know, Kim can pull out his clarinet, get a little Dixieland going.
That's right. Yeah, why not?
I like this idea. The only question I have, though, Brent Spiner coming on is Data playing violin. If we've got Avery on the keys, you know, you've got Frakes on the bone, you've got Wong on the clarinet doing Dixieland style, do you think Data can play fiddle, or is it just like classical violin that he does?
You know, I have a feeling he could probably I think he could probably do it. He's just got to download the fiddle program.
I guess. I'm just concerned, you know, you got to feel that Dixieland. I'm concerned it might just come off as a little bit robotic or androidish. I'm sorry, I don't want to offend Data.
it might, but I don't know. I don't know any way to get around. Maybe after he gets his emotion chip, he could play a little bit more emotionally.
Oh, that's a good point. That's probably what it's going to be. All right. So this is over on Indiegogo. You can go over and donate. Funds will help film the pilot episode, and 5% of all funds will go to the Los Angeles Mission, which is an organization that is designed to provide help, hope, and opportunity to men, women, and children in need in the Los Angeles area. So a great cause there that Michael Dorn is supporting as well. So if you're interested in seeing this happen, go over. We'll put a link in the show notes and you can contribute and help Mr. Worf, Michael Dorn, get this project off the ground. Also, one other thing that I wanted to mention today, Daniel, is we're going to add a new segment to the Ready Room. Now, of course, here at Trek FM, we talk about the Trek FM crew, and we're kind of like, you know, one ship here, the Trek FM crew. But, you know, all of our listeners, all of you guys are part of the fleet. And what we want to do in the Ready Room is we want to have you ask us questions. It's questions from the fleet. Daniel, what if you were a member out there in the fleet and you were going to ask a question? Give me one question. What would you ask?
Oh, boy. Putting me on the spot here, Chris. If I had to ask the Ready Room crew a question, and this is something I think about myself a lot, is if you could take one crew of one of the shows and put them in an episode of one of the other shows, which would it be?
Okay, good question. I think I would take Tuvok from Voyager and I would put him in the Mirror Universe. And, oh, wait, they already did that. So, no, that's a really good question. One thing that I have always been interested in is I would love to see how Captain Picard would handle the crew and all the people who live on Deep Space Nine. So I think it would be interesting to have an episode where Captain Picard is in command of the station temporarily, you know, because of the storyline would be such that he's there to help out with something, and then Sisko leaves to go take care of some aspect of that mission, and then Picard is in command, and then there's some kind of crisis on the station, and Picard has to handle it. I'm curious to see how Picard would handle a crisis where it's not that, you know, clean-cut environment like he has on the Enterprise, where he's clearly in command. You know, there's a lot of different things going on, a lot of tug of war, a lot of people who don't care that he's Starfleet. I would like to see how that would play out.
Right, like how would Picard respond to Kira screaming in the office in the first episode? Yeah. There, you know, I mean, wouldn't that be interesting?
Exactly.
Or if they were in a crisis situation, how would Picard deal with Garak or Quark? You know, that would be really interesting to see.
That is something that, well, it's actually coming up in a novel, but that's something we've talked about on the Orb before. We would really like to see Picard and Garak. You know, how does that play out? Absolutely. All right. So yeah, stuff like that. So if you have questions about Star Trek, send them in. Just go over to trek.fm/contact and use that form, choose a show, choose the Ready Room, type your question in the form there, and that'll come over to us. And we're really looking forward to hearing the questions that you guys have out there. And I think it'll be a fun new way to get into new discussions on the Ready Room. And of course, a great way for you listeners to be more involved in the show. Okay, Daniel, that's it for news today. Before we jump into our discussion of The Devil in the Dark, and Shar and Drew are going to join us, let's tell everyone about our sponsor for this week's show, Squarespace. Now, your support of Squarespace is really important to helping us bring the Ready Room to you. And it's a really great platform, an all-in-one platform that combines hosting and content management, and it makes it really simple for you to create your own space online. That could be a blog, a website, a portfolio, an online store, really anything that you can imagine. You can do it very easily there. I've been using Squarespace for 6 years. I love them. Trek FM is built on Squarespace, and apart from the fact that the tools are just really awesome, they're constantly improving the platform with new features and new designs and even better support. And amazingly, you get all of this for just $8 a month. That's the starting price. And if you choose the annual plan, you can get a free custom domain registration as well. And Daniel, we've talked about this on the show before, but I wanted to again highlight three reasons that I really love Squarespace. And the first of those is that it's design focused. You know, I'm a designer and I really care about good design and interfaces. And not only what the user sees when they visit your website, but also what I'm using when I'm creating the website as well. And Squarespace gives you both of those through the beautifully designed templates that are extremely clean. They're professionally designed. It's very easy for you to modify them and make the site your own. And they always bring your content to the forefront and make that the focus of your website. The other one is connected accounts, which ties into social media. And Daniel, you spend a lot of time in social media, don't you?
I do. I mean, really, who doesn't nowadays? You know, if you're listening to a podcast, chances are you have a Facebook account or Twitter or Instagram. You're on something. Who isn't on social media these days anyways?
Right. And that's how you find a lot of the stuff that you read or a lot of the stuff that you listen to, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's probably my main source these days. I really hop around just looking for stuff anymore. I wait for it to come to me through social media. And Squarespace makes it very easy for you to push your content out in that way. Through connected accounts, you know, you can set up Twitter so that when you put a new post or a new piece of content or a new item, if it's a store on your website, it'll push that right out to Twitter for you. And with Facebook, you can go into the Facebook interface and you can connect Squarespace and you can choose a page from your site to share right there on Facebook, which is really fantastic. In addition to that, you can tie into Pinterest, Instagram, Google, just pretty much any social media site that you use frequently. Squarespace is always working to connect those together. Also, there's responsive design. Daniel, how often do you read websites on your smartphone or your tablet these days?
That I would actually say it's probably split 50-50 with a traditional PC or laptop kind of a situation.
Yeah, I think that's the case for most people. It's probably like that for me too. You know, I still read on my desktop a lot, but I spend a lot of time on my mobile devices as well. And so essentially I've got three different screen sizes and different orientations as well, depending on how I'm holding the device. I don't pick my monitor up and flip it. Don't worry about that. But, you know, my smartphone or my tablet, I do that. So, and the great thing about Squarespace's responsive design is that you just design the website once and it will reflow for whatever display the user is using to view the site. So it's going to look great on the desktop. It's going to look great on your iPhone, your Android phone, your tablet, your iPad. And it's gonna change depending on that screen so that the content is appropriate for the platform that you're using. So that's fantastic. And you get all of that for free. It's just built right into the Squarespace platform. Daniel, they also added a commerce feature recently. And I think last time you were here, you said you were going to be setting up your store to sell your Pokemon Star Trek crossover items.
Yeah, it's true. In the move, it got delayed, but it's something I'm still planning on doing, you know. But I mean, it's amazing. Like, you can set up a store in just a few clicks, in just a few minutes. It takes all the hassle out of it. So if, say, the t-shirt contest we mentioned, say your t-shirt design doesn't get made or you don't like any of them, you can make your own, sell it on Squarespace, and there you go. Well, you know, trademark, copyright all of those laws, make sure you take those into account. But, you know, you could sell your own t-shirts. It's super easy to do.
So a very, very powerful platform. Try it out for yourself. Go over to squarespace.com. You can get a free 14-day trial. There's no credit card required. You can use all the tools and see how Squarespace can give you everything that you need to create an exceptional website. And then when you decide to sign up, and I know you're going to want to, use our offer code TREK8 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And as I mentioned at the beginning, choose that annual plan and you'll get your own custom domain registration absolutely free. And it's really, really easy to tie that into Squarespace. So you can have your name.com and you're all set to go. So we really thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM. We really thank you for supporting Squarespace. Again, squarespace.com, offer code TREK8. And that makes it possible for us to bring the Ready Room to you every week. The mission of the Enterprise, and you know, really any Star Trek crew, is to seek out new life and new civilizations. And that's exactly what they did when they visited Janus VI. But sometimes our reactions to truly alien life are not what they perhaps should be. And today we're going to talk about the realities of our exploration and our reactions to those who are different from us through the Devil in the Dark. And to help us do that, we have with us our managing editor, Charlene Schmidt. Hello, Char.
What up, kittens?
Fresh back. Well, not fresh back. It's been a couple of weeks now since you returned from Las Vegas.
A good solid week. I'm almost recovered.
So, almost. Yeah, you're almost over the hangover?
Just about. Although I've had some vodka since, so...
That's the best way to cure a hangover.
Well, of course.
Hair of the dog. Yeah.
Sometimes.
Hair of the Horda?
Or you could use nanites like the Borg, right, to cure hangovers.
I could maybe use some of those.
And also, of course, we have with us our TOS editor, Drew Stewart. Hello, Landrew.
Joy to you, friends.
Now, Landrew, I noticed that you're not wearing red right now. You're wearing kind of a yellowish gold color, so I assume that you are ready to go down into the caves of Janus VI.
Yes, I know that I will survive.
Good for you, buddy.
If there was ever a mission where you needed to put in a request for division change or at least a temporary wardrobe change, maybe, you know, get some sauce on your red tunic so you'd have to wear a different one, this is the mission.
Seriously, like, orange jumpsuit is the new red shirt.
Yeah.
In this episode.
That's great.
But then red shirt is still red shirt. You're screwed either way.
I was totally thinking that, though. When I saw that, I said, orange is the new red.
Homage to orange is the new black. Yeah.
While we're on the topic of the miners' uniforms, though, before we really get into the discussion here, you know how when there's the Super Bowl or the national championship game or something, and they print shirts for both teams ahead of time where they won the game, And then whoever loses, they send that stuff to Africa or somewhere to, you know, to use as clothing. These miners on Janus 6, they clearly received all of the rejected first-run Starfleet uniforms where they didn't quite have the color palette right.
Yeah, the magenta is my personal favorite, or that right? Fuchsia, whatever you want to call it.
Instead of gold, red, and blue, they have kind of bright yellow, magenta, and orange. Just a little too bright. They didn't get the color mixture right in the dyes.
They probably were rejected uniforms. Like, well, we need to show off the color TVs. And so they brought out these giant things. And Roddenberry's like, no.
We need to show off the color TVs. So get the ugliest colors you can think of.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that people's TVs start blowing out, you know, like they used to when you had to adjust the color and like the reds are way too hot and bleeding. And
it's so bright, it causes the vertical hold to go crazy.
Yes.
Trying to tune it back in. All right. Well, okay. So The Devil in the Dark, Landru, it's TOS week and I asked you for an episode suggestion and you immediately said, how about The Devil in the Dark? And I had actually just watched this episode about 2 weeks ago as I'm making my way back through TOS. And why did you choose this episode?
Well, I was looking at the... I wanted to do something, an episode that I knew really well, that I'd seen many times, that we all know about and we all could talk about. And I was looking through the spreadsheet that I keep of all of the episodes and who co-hosted so that I remember what episodes we've done. And so I'm like, oh gosh, we're going to have to go through. I'm going to have to scroll through this whole thing. And I sort by TOS and there's only like 8. So I'm like, oh, okay, never mind. We've got plenty of episodes. Devil in the Dark, sure.
That's right. Yeah. In the early days of the Ready Room, we didn't go through the rotation like we do now. And so there were fewer TOS episodes, I think, in the first, you know, 20 or 30 Ready Rooms.
That must be it.
Yeah.
Because there's not that many. So we've got plenty to talk about.
So I remember this episode from watching it as a kid, and then I've watched it more times than I can count up to this point. But Char, what do you think about The Devil in the Dark? First thoughts?
My first thought is this should be a Halloween episode because they're sort of pseudo trying to scare you, but it's not really that scary. But if you were a kid, maybe you'd find it a little scary. In the 1960s, you could buy the special effects.
Especially when the Horda attacks. I want to know, how did they mount the POV camera on the Horda? Because you always get the same view when it attacks.
Well, I'm imagining the guy who was crawling on his hands and knees with the carpet on his back just had the cameraman riding him like they were playing horsey.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Riding the Horda. That's probably how they did it.
In fact, the Horda kind of reminds me of some weird cross between a caterpillar and Snuffleupagus from Sesame Street, only with like molten lava and tumors growing out of it.
Well, yeah, that's what the guy says about it. He says that the monster is big and shaggy.
Right? Yeah. So there you go.
Soinks.
So,
like, wow, we better watch out for this monster, Scoob.
A monster. Yes, I have to read a lot of Scooby-Doo stories to my children, so I've got my Scooby voice down.
Hang on, that would have been great then if there was a sequence where the Horda was chasing Kirk and Spock into one cave
through tunnels,
and then they come out on the other side.
Oh my god!
And then all of a sudden they reverse that, and then Kirk and Spock are chasing the Horda, and yeah, that'd be great.
And then at the end, the best part is when they come up to the Horda, they pull the mask off the Horda, and it's Vanderberg.
Right.
Yeah. He wanted all the mining operation to himself.
You guys, this was the best, like, missed opportunity for the animated series ever.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh. Absolutely.
And they instead could have of the Tribble crossover. King, it could have been it could have been the Horda matriarch.
I'm so sad we did not get this.
It would have been awesome. Scooby-Doo animated series, Star Trek animated series crossover where you've got all the characters together in the same episode. They used to do that sometimes.
Somehow the mystery machine has wings and flies.
It's like the shuttlecraft.
Yeah.
Following the Enterprise. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And Fred says, I'm going to drive her apart.
Drive her apart
drive her
then.
Apart, then.
Awesome. Well, Daniel, what did you think about this episode the first time you saw it?
Oh man, I don't even know when the first time I saw it. I mean, it's one of those episodes. It's like a classic episode. Everybody's seen it, you know, dozens and thousands and bajillions of times. But it's just an episode that you watch and you really enjoy. Like every single time you watch it, it's like you don't get sick of it. At least I don't. I really enjoy kind of the themes and the Hort. Like even though it's kind of hokey and cheesy now, but it's classic. So it stands the test of time for sure.
Definitely. Well, let's talk about the central point of this episode for me anyway, which is to seek out new life. And we talk about space exploration and we go out there and in reality, you know, something like the Hort is probably more likely what we'll find than, I don't know if it'll be as intelligent as the Horta. I don't know if it will be able to burn grammatically incorrect sentences into the ground or not, but
you never know.
But you know, Star Trek has kind of trained us that all life in the universe pretty much looks like us. It's humanoid. It's, you know, got some nose ridges. Maybe it's got some fancy tattoos or something, and that's kind of it. But, you know, this is probably more like what we'll find out there. And it's interesting that you guys know the old show, The Outer Limits. And Gene L. Coons saw the final episode of that show that was produced was called The Probe, and the space probe comes to Earth. And there's this, like, giant microorganism that comes with it. And thank goodness Janeway wasn't there because, you know, she'd be getting her,
was it
getting her muscles out. Yeah, she's going to blast that, you know, like in Macrocosm. But so this microorganism comes and Kuhn saw the story and it gave him an idea for this script. So he wrote The Devil in the Dark and he got the artist, Janos Prohaska, who created the creature from the Outer Limits story to design the Horta. And it's interesting that his name is Janos and then the planet here is Janus 6. I don't know myself if there's a connection there or not, but it certainly sounds like some inspiration to me. But, you know, they created this really unique creature in the Horta, which is the kind of thing I think we should see more often on Star Trek. And then it raises the question of how do we react when we explore and we find here on Earth, if you think about history, and then in the future, thinking about space, people or life forms that truly are different from us. Of course, here on Earth, people really weren't very different from us. It's very superficial, and we still had that very, very negative reaction to it. And here they're faced with something truly alien.
Like, think about how difficult we have it. I mean, like, judging people by their skin color or their hair color or stupid things like that. And then imagine what we would do with life that is completely unlike our own. It's definitely something to think about, and that's what TOS is about. That's what Star Trek is supposed to be about, making you think about things. This is kind of a story about racism and judging people, and it's a lot less black and white as Let That Be Your Last Battlefield.
Right, yeah.
I went there. It was a bad pun, I'm sorry.
I knew you were going to bring
that
up.
Way to go.
But it's true. I mean, this is a better story because it covers the same topics as Let That Be Your Last Battlefield in many ways, but it does it in the way that, you know, you would expect Star Trek to do, maybe a little bit more, where they're actually out there seeking out new life and new civilizations.
And it also tries to make you think outside of your own point of view. Like, This story really boils down to the man is the real enemy. Like, we're the real monster.
We are. Because
you think that the Horta is the monster and it's killing these people. It's like a Scooby-Doo episode or a horror movie or Outer Limits or something. But then when it comes down to it, we started it because we didn't understand. We were just like, look at these rocks, and start smashing all the rocks. And so the Horta is just protecting its future generations because it's the protector, the last guardian.
Right.
And it's just it's supposed to help you look outside of yourself and like, look, we may be having our perception wrong, and we need to look at it from another angle and see that we're the ones who are causing this, who are having the problem.
Yeah.
And that if we stop and talk about it through telekinesis, or not telekinesis, but, you know, mind melds and stuff, which thankfully the Enterprise had somebody like that.
Yeah, being open-minded, because at the end of the episode, when Kirk tells Vandenberg and the mob that, you know, these nodules are actually their eggs, and he says, we didn't know, how could we? And my immediate reaction is, because you never even tried to think about the possibility, right? You're very, very closed-minded about
yes.
it.
Yes. Okay, thank right. you. One thing that kind of bothers me is just how narrow these people's perception is of what life is. Because I totally agree with you, Chris. I think life, beyond our understanding of it, we consider the carbon-based life forms essentially true life, all of life, because that's what we understand. But when we go out there, there's probably so many different ways that life exists in the universe based off of any number of ingredients that's completely unlike us. And it's really stupid of us to not consider that. So by the 23rd century, we should really have that ingrained because of space travel. I mean, yeah. It just makes sense to me, but apparently not to these miners. And really, well, even Kirk and company are still not quite there either. It takes them a while to come around and realize what they're dealing with.
Well, these are miners. I mean, I'm not judging the mental capacity of miner workers in the 23rd century. But, I mean, their job is to dig rock. They dig rock, they find minerals, that's what they do. Living rock, just, it would never occur to them. Rock is, you dig rock.
Are you saying
gem.
They're cavemen?
I'm saying they're cavemen or dwarves.
Oh, okay, so you're going Snow White on us.
You know, they dug too deep and too greedily.
Okay. So, remember that this episode was written in the 1960s, and to us today, the idea of silicon-based life is perfectly normal. I mean, you know, we don't think, and a lot of that's thanks to Star Trek and other science fiction, but also, you know, discoveries that science has made. But when this was being written in the 1960s, this idea was new, and there was this chemist named Alexander Graham Cairn Smith, really long name, and he had been developing the theory that it was possible that there could be life based on silicon, and that the first life on Earth was probably clay minerals, and that was a bridge between, you know, the biological life that we know now, carbon-based life, and what was before. And he published a book in 1985 called Seven Clues to the Origin of Life, which became kind of a controversial thing. But this theory, anyway, in the mid-1960s was kind of a new thing. And so when we look at this episode now, it's easy for us to look back and think, like, certainly by the 23rd century, they should have thought about the fact that the Horta could be alive. But I think Star Trek is doing a really good thing here of breaking new ground to the audience at the time and saying, hey, you need to break out of your conventional thinking and remember that the world and the universe is much more diverse than you think it is. And even play that over to the race issues here, you know, that, hey, look, just because your neighbor has a different skin color than you or lives in a different part of the world than you, you're actually pretty much the same. Here's something truly alien. And at the time that this was written and the time that it aired, I think it was actually breaking new ground.
You make a good point, Chris.
I agree, Chris. But the one problem I have is the way that the miners are written, because even if maybe this concept is kind of alien to them, or which makes sense, okay, as it was written in the 60s, the problem I have is that Spock explains that these nodules are geographically unique, to say the least, and they're so easily dismissive of them. They're just like, I'll put it on my desk as an ornament and crack them open and make an omelet, you know, but they don't ever think that, hey, this could be something more significant than just completely perfect spheres that we find in the thousands and the millions.
Yeah. Cisco has his baseball, Vanderberg has his nodule. And if you go in his office and the nodule's still there, you know he's coming back.
I guess.
For the remastered, if there's one thing that I don't like, it's when they go too far and like mess with existing live action shots. But it does disappoint me that there's no, like when Kirk steps into the room and he's like, "Well, look, there's billions of eggs," and yeah, there's none because we're just seeing it from. I would have liked to see a beautiful CG thing of just eggs all over the place, like, you know, with mm-hmm. Kirk really small looking as the camera pulls back or something.
Something like what they did in the comics when they did Operation Annihilate, and they go in and you actually get that depth perception of the characters being very small, and they're all the fried egg aliens, which actually look kind of scary in the comic, but they're all over mm-hmm. the place, right? Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. But then I would have complained about it.
But yeah, Daniel, I mean, you make a good point there that they're very, very dismissive of these things. Although I think that, and I thought about that actually when I was watching the episode again this morning, and I was thinking about, you know, why are the miners written the way they are? But I almost think Gene L. Coon wrote them that way intentionally just to make the point about how closed-minded people are about things that are different, especially in the scenes when Kirk and Spock are in there with the Horda and McCoy is trying to patch him up because he's a bricklayer now. And you've got the mob outside and they're like, "Let's go kill it. Let's go kill it." And that's just the mentality that a lot of people have. And especially in the 60s, a lot of people had about other races.
Yeah, that's actually... You just mentioned two more pieces of evidence that, or that I can think of that kind of indicate that the miners are kind of idiots. The fact that they think they can beat up this rock monster with their clubs, like, let's get him, let's beat him up. Like, okay,
we don't have enough phasers for you all. We'll use clubs.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
Wait a minute. That doesn't make any sense. And the other thing is that there is a piece of technology they have that is just working barely, and it breaks down, and it's so vital to the colony for everything, for air and heat. And they're like, "Oh, we don't have any spares or anything. We never thought that would break."
I have that in my notes too, because not only that, not only could it break, and it all their life support relies upon that. Also, if it breaks, it could poison half the planet. And beyond that, yeah, 12 other planets depend on that production facility. And they have no backup for this antiquated system.
And it's so specialized that, you know, the flagship, I guess it wasn't the flagship at the time, but like this super advanced Federation ship can't even make a spare. Yeah. Or barely rig one up. It's like,
which is absurd.
What is this thing made out of?
Especially at the end of the episode when he picks it up and it's like these two pieces of pipe kind of put together.
Right.
Like,
I know,
Scotty,
right?
You can't make that? Come on, bud.
Apparently not. And yeah, apparently this is a really bad case of invincibility syndrome. It's not going to happen to me.
Yeah, right. And my question too is, how did the Horda steal that piece of equipment and hide it when the Horda corrodes everything that it touches, apparently?
I guess it corrodes...
only when it wants to.
I mean, because it was able to write, so I imagine it can control...
It can control its corrosion. Controlled corrosion, yes.
Apparently.
Otherwise, Spock would be melted halfway through the episode.
Oh, no, I've got it. Yeah, exactly. No, I've got it. Because my other question was, how did it carry the piece of equipment away when it apparently has no arms or legs? But as you pointed out, Drew, at the beginning, the cameraman who rides the Horda, he held on to it while they rode back to the caves.
He tucked it underneath his shirt and it was fine.
Could have jousted with it.
Shh, shh, we could do this. Come on.
So the other thing, you talked about man being the bad guy here, Drew, and
the real monster.
That's right. One thing I like about this episode too is that it tells us at the end that even if life is completely alien to us, here you've got the Horda, silicon-based life, looks nothing like us whatsoever, but in the end it says, "Cry for the children, walk carefully in the vault of tomorrow." And it's just showing that even though this alien is completely different from us, it basically shares the same hopes and fears and sorrows that we have, because ultimately it's doing everything that it's doing to protect its children and to allow its species to move on to the next generation. And if you think about ourselves, everything that we do every day, in the end, it comes down to the children too. In everything we build in society, everything that we do as parents, even things we do before we're parents to prepare ourselves for later in life, in the end, it really all boils down to children and continuing our race and our species. And that's why we get, you know, all the atrocities that can happen in the world. If they happen to children, it's like 10 times worse for us, because in the end, that's how our brains are wired. And here, it's kind of the same thing for the Horda.
Especially for this particular one, because it was tasked, you know, 50,000 years ago?
50,000, yeah.
50,000 years ago with protect these eggs. That's your one job for the next 50,000 years. And yeah, so it's like super mom.
Yeah, very much. You have one millions job, of kids
for 50,000 years.
I'm glad we brought this up, though, because any organism that has that kind of evolutionary life cycle, I think, would be extinct pretty quickly. If all of a sudden you're down to one creature to protect everything else.
Every 50,000 years.
How does that work? Yeah. I don't know how. I mean, I guess it's silicon, so we're not supposed to understand it. It's whatever, but it's...
And... Well, wouldn't there be a point if they can go through rocks so easily that they would have depleted that entire planet of its resources in the last 50,000 years?
That's a good point, yeah. Or
the 100,000 years before that, three or four cycles that they've been through, probably?
Maybe. Well, so. never mind. Yeah, sorry. I was going to say if the Horda was eating the rock, then it would have to excrete the rock, but it's not eating the rock, so I guess that's not a fair point anyways.
That's a different cave, Daniel. There's the Vault of Tomorrow where all the eggs are, and then there's the neighboring
There's
cave.
A Vault of Yesterday.
Yes, the Vault of Yesterday. Exactly. I don't know, it's a weird concept, because what they say is that every 50,000 years, the entire race dies, except for one Horda. And then that Horda protects the eggs, and then she's the mother of the race when all the eggs hatch. Now, they don't really say how long it takes the eggs to hatch. That's not quite clear. It's just like every 50,000 years, every single Horda dies except one. So maybe it's like a short period of time.
Maybe it's like 5 years or something.
I don't know.
And to answer your question, Drew, about the depleting rock, perhaps like in a weird circle of life kind of thing, all the dead Hordas... all the 49,999 other Hordas turn into the rock.
That makes perfect sense.
Maybe that's why they found all those weird, like, uranium and all that kind of stuff in there. Maybe it's actually Horda corpses.
Very, very possible. Preserved after thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah. Vandenberg said that just... every kind of mineral, everything you can imagine is on this planet. So I wonder if at Starfleet Command, if there was a big fracking debate about Gen 6.
I'm sure there was.
Well, let's move to a lighter topic for a moment, which is the great phaser debate. We always wonder about how phasers work in Star Trek. And I think this episode could be the definitive primer on phasers, because... we have the phaser 1 versus phaser 2 debate, which is, you know, it's a lot like a Three Stooges thing or a Monty Python sketch. We've got the debate over whether it's better to use multiple phasers or a single phaser with longer contact. And we also find out that apparently, besides stun and kill, Starfleet phasers of this time period also have a silicon setting, because Kirk says our phasers were set to silicon.
Maybe that's the setting that they use, like, I mean, what setting is it that Chekhov uses when he's cold and, you know, and he just burns the rock and it just heats up? I mean, like, and Sulu does it too. Like, maybe there's a setting that just heats rock, that reacts to rock, because it doesn't burn a hole in it and it doesn't vaporize it. I mean, so there must be a rock setting. I mean, there must have always been.
He said phasers to rock.
Yeah! Mine's on paper.
It's a very weak beam, but it still vaporizes the paper.
Yeah.
I just, there's a point in this episode where it's like, okay, I get it. Phaser one, phaser two. Okay. It's like they just talk about the phasers a whole lot in here. I bet Malcolm Reed would have loved to have been in this episode. All right. So I don't know. Did you guys gain anything else out of the great phaser debate other than a little chuckle?
I haven't.
Or were you just really?
No. I wish there's more, like, I like seeing them put the phaser one in the phaser two thing. Put the one in the two. It's always exciting. Yeah, you don't get much like phaser recalibration action. Like my favorite part of Star Trek Into Darkness is when Kirk pulls out the phasers out of Khan's backpack and just like pops them together and it turns into a full phaser. I'm like, what? That's awesome. I want to do that. Phaser building. I like phaser building.
did you order the Star Trek Into Darkness that comes with the phaser replica?
No, I already have one. Okay. I've got the one that it doesn't spin, but I've got the one from the first movie. And then I dropped it and broke the end off of it.
The phaser rifle so that we could get a picture of you making that face that Kirk makes when he shoots the phaser rifle. And you used that as your avatar for a while, I remember.
That'd be awesome.
That would be great. Well,
I could do that.
I also mentioned Kirk lining everyone up. And another thing in this episode is you get to see the six or the eight, or if we remember that one guy dies in between the two lineups, the nine unluckiest guys on the ship. And I mentioned at the beginning that, you know, this is an episode where you want to request a wardrobe change. It's Drew, you've been through all the TOS stuff. You're our TOS editor. Is this the largest concentration of red shirts anywhere in the series?
I imagine that it is.
I feel like it is.
I mean, there's usually not very many deaths. It may be close to, what's the planet where like the red shirts get shot with the plants?
Oh, yeah.
And Spock gets shot with it too.
In the apple?
A lot of red shirts die on that one. But like, I mean, that was just one party. That was just one set of six people who beamed down. So I imagine this is probably the highest red shirt death count, which doesn't help I'm tired of the red shirt cliche thing.
But it's true in TOS.
I wish it would just go away. It's true, especially in this episode.
But I don't know about death count here, but what gets me about this one is that usually when red shirts die, I mean, it's kind of like a joke. Yeah, it's like this guy's sitting on a log. He's wearing a red shirt. He's the one that's going to get killed. But what cracks me up about this particular episode is that Kirk is actually lining them all up in a line and giving them orders to
go and disperse through
this network of tunnels in a cave where we know that there's some kind of creature that's dissolving people. And you know,
that's
they're
their
all
job.
Like, they're like, oh shit, I should not have come on this mission.
To be fair.
This is what they've trained for.
To be fair, though, I actually think the ultimate red shirt in this episode is the first miner that shows up in the teaser of the episode because he knows. He's got this weird smile on. He knows he's going to die.
Then the
guy's like, look, just we can get someone down here in 3 minutes. And then he's like, I love his line. A lot can happen in 3 minutes. And then 13 seconds later, he's dead.
He knew.
He knew it was coming.
You just get that bad feeling.
That guy reminded me of in the Galileo 7, where it's like, I don't want to stand guard here. Don't leave me here to stand guard. That's gonna happen. You'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Giant spear right through.
Giant spear.
These are like the meta red shirts. They know what's going on.
Yeah. You know you're not coming back ever again.
Yeah.
Your guesting on this show is over.
But also on the,
I think a Star
unless you come back next week with a different name.
On the other, on the flip
yes,
side,
that happens too.
the head guy there, Commander Giotto or something like that. I think he gets the most character development of any red shirt. I mean, he's a commander. He's like all the way throughout the episode. He's a big stocky guy. He's in charge of everyone. I thought he was pretty cool.
If you reach commander rank as a red shirt, you're like the elderly Klingon. Right? It's like somehow you survived to have gray hair as a Klingon. If you're a red shirt and you're a commander, I mean, you must be really, really good at your job.
You're a lifer.
Yeah. And think of all those years of hazard pay. So,
well, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, he's long lived, because I imagine that they go through ranks rather quickly. Well, everyone above you is dead, so I guess you're in charge now.
And the gray hair is just
from
stress.
This is not the mirror universe, Landru.
Right.
Maybe what it means, though, is that he's really good at avoiding away mission duty.
Ah, yeah.
Because he's delegating.
I imagine you. Yeah. If you're higher ranked, you'd just be like, you three, Kirk needs red shirts.
Yeah.
It's like the way you become a manager in a big company is you find a way to get other people to do the work, but you take the credit for it.
Yes.
Right. Right. Yep.
Red shirt managers.
All right. Well, let's move on to, okay, another big topic here is, I was watching this again and I'm thinking this is one giant leap for mind melds, because the mind meld was conceived of in Dagger of the Mind as a way for Spock to perform hypnosis. And here we get more development for the mind meld. And also one thing I had forgotten about until I was watching the episode again now is that we get non-contact mind melding initially here.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if you want to retcon this through Enterprise, I was wondering if this is a way to avoid Pinar syndrome.
Safe mind melding.
Yes. You don't touch. No touching.
Abstinent mind melding. That's what...
Abstinence. Well, this episode aired shortly after Taste of Armageddon, which I talked about with Colin earlier today. And it was on the same disc, so on my Blu-ray. And in Taste of Armageddon, that's the one where Spock mind melds through the wall to convince the guy to open up the door for them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they'd started playing with mind melds again at this point in the show, but still the rules are fast and loose. He's just like, first we're going to hypnotize people and now we can control them. And then we can just stand near something. And like, maybe the Horta was kind of telepathic too. Maybe that had something to do with it. He was just like being a receptor.
Maybe.
Because the Horta knew all about the machinery and knew what to take and stuff. So the Horta had to have been reading somebody's mind. I mean, I don't think he was like hiding in the shadows and watching them to see, you know, like this is obviously an important piece. I think that the Horta has some kind of mental power also.
Do you guys think that Marina Sirtis in Encounter at Farpoint or in Tin Man, where she feels pain, did she watch this episode and take acting inspiration from Leonard Nimoy when he stands near the Horta?
She must
have. I hope
have.
So. Pain.
My favorite story from Shatner's Star Trek Memories book is from after that episode, or during that episode was filming, and like Shatner had just come back from somebody's funeral or something. He really
his
wasn't
dad
feeling
died.
Up
for, he got a phone call during the filming of this episode informing him that his dad died, and all the stuff from the scenes of the mind meld, all that stuff was done on the same day after he got the phone call that his father had passed away.
And and so they're doing the thing and Nimoy's like, pain, and Shatner just goes, God, get that Vulcan an aspirin.
That's right.
Because my dad read these books before he gave them to me, and I remember dad sharing that story with me. So it's like, and then I think he showed me the episode.
Yeah.
That may have been the first time I'd seen it, was he showed me the episode. Okay. It's just like, Shatner was really funny at that point.
It's interesting, if you watch Shatner here, that you would think that, you know, receiving that phone call, they say that the crew offered, like, we'll not finish shooting today because that's a very traumatic experience. And this actually happened to me last year. I was about to leave for work, and this is where I was teaching some classes as well. And 15 minutes before I left, I got a phone call from my aunt that my father had died, and I had to go, you know, like I can't call and say I'm not going to show up now. So I had to go and still do everything with that on my mind. And I'm watching Shatner do that here. But in this situation, because of the scene with the Horda and what they were doing and how they were communicating, and the Horda is trying to convey concern over the death of her children that the miners had done, I watch Shatner's face now specifically to see, like, how is he reacting knowing that he got that phone call. And it's he does a great job of holding everything together, you know, acting, providing a great performance. But that news also, I think, can even enhance what he's doing here, because he, like, really had that topic on his mind kind of raw at that moment.
Yeah, very possible.
So the mind melding here, though, I often like to joke about this episode that, yeah, you know, Spock mind melds with Hot Rock and such, but but it's really not Hot Rock, because it does seem that when we remember this episode, maybe it's because the Horda is kind of red and looks like a pizza or something, you know, molten rock. I think the Horda is not actually hot, right? Unless it wants to be, unless it wants to burn something into the ground, or whether it wants to shoot acid out at somebody.
Yeah.
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 I don't know.
Or Vulcan pain tolerance is a lot higher than we thought.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it probably is.
But, I mean, and he would be able to hold, you know, ow, that hurt. Well, you're bleeding. I don't know. You know, because he's holding in their feelings, their emotions. I guess pain is kind of an emotion.
Well, then you've also got that weird fungus-like texture on the Horda, maybe to cool it off a little bit.
Maybe those are sacks, acid sacks or something.
Or asbestos sacks.
Very possible.
What did you think, though, about the idea of Spock mind melding, though, with the Horda? Because, again, as we've been talking about throughout the show, the central point of this episode is that, you know, alien life could be really, really alien to us. And how do we connect with that life? And Do we share anything with that life? And here, the implication again is that, yes, the Horda is made of silicon. It's literally rock, or I think Bones actually says it's virtually rock. And I was thinking, well, it's literally rock. But somehow...
It's figuratively rock.
That's right. But somehow, there is a connection. You know, Spock is able to communicate. I mean, did that work for you? Or did you think it was just ridiculous that Spock could do this?
I wondered, like, does Spock have to mind meld with, like, somebody's head? Or was that, like, the Horta's ass, and he's just, like, grabbing its butt and able to read its mind?
He's groping the Horta?
He's groping the Horta, and the Horta's like, what are you doing?
Landry,
pain,
my head's
pain.
Up here.
Landry, remember, you've got to be open-minded. Not all aliens keep their brains in the same places.
It's true.
I was lucky that Horta had knees.
It's kind of a... I mean, you have to give it to the story. It's the only way it would make sense. It's the only way you can move forward to communicate with the creature is through something like Spock. It's definitely a suspension of disbelief, though. I think it's almost a suspension of disbelief enough to think that he could communicate telepathically with humans or other aliens, you know, let alone something that's composed of a completely different element. So if you think about it, I don't think it makes any sense, but it works for the story. Otherwise, how are you going to communicate with this rock?
Right.
I mean,
that was my
thoughts
issue too.
Are thoughts. So,
well, that's not
I
fair
mean,
because it, even in, like, you know, the later series, you can't telepathically communicate with a Ferengi because they have a four-lobed brain, right? So I mean, think of not only this thing might not even have a brain as we know it. It would have some sort of silicon something, maybe a brain. I guess you could call it that.
Spock mind melds with Nomad.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking.
Literally
about.
Mind meld with a computer. If it has thoughts, yeah. He can read them. That's just how it works. wish she'd mind meld with my dog, figure out what my dog's thinking, you know?
Seriously.
You should do this, Drew. I know Leonard Nimoy has retired from conventions, but there's always the possibility, you know, he might make a special guest appearance somewhere. Take your dog with you, go up to Leonard Nimoy and ask him if you can at least take a photo of him mind melding with your dog.
I'm sure Nimoy would
My dog,
love
of
that.
Course, would be dressed as a Horta.
Oh, nice. Now that would be a sight to see.
I need a big shaggy dog, though.
I was wondering who's underneath that Horta costume rolling around.
I know. I want to see behind-the-scenes photos of... I want to see, like, the Horta outfit, like, hung up. Like, the rug just hung up on something.
It had to have been a person, though, because in the episode, Kirk plays, you know, red light, green light with it. When he's holding up the phaser, and it backs away, and then puts down the phaser, and the Horta creeps up, so...
Yeah.
I wanted to be on set. Move forward. No, go back. Okay, now move forward again.
And then finally Kirk shoots the Horta. The Horta's like, what the hell? Kirk says, I didn't say Simon Says. Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, Daniel, because one other thing here, this is something I think Kirk doesn't get enough credit for, is that Kirk exhibits what we now think of as a very Picard-like reaction to the Horta here, because he's surrounded by these people who are like, just kill it, just kill it. And even Spock is telling him, kill it. But Kirk is kind of testing the Horta and seeing, the Horta's not going to hurt me. Let's just see what's going on here. And he's very calm about it. And, I mean, you get the feeling that Kirk, like if the Horta really came at him, he would have shot it. But he doesn't take this attitude like, I don't know what this is, so I'm just going to charge in here and shoot it. It's very much a contemplative and a diplomatic approach to new life. And I think, you know, Kirk really does understand the core of his mission for Starfleet here. This is a new life for
him. It's weird because Spock and Kirk completely flip opinions on that as soon as Kirk gets in the cave with the Horta. Because before, Kirk is like... I don't care if it's the last of its kind. This isn't a zoological expedition. Kill it. You shoot it right away. And Spock's like, oh, but it's the last one. And then...
He was so depressed. He just plays with his tricorder. He's like, okay.
But then Kirk's in the cave with it. And then Kirk's the one that's like, no, don't shoot it, Spock. And Spock's like, kill it, kill it.
This also takes us back to the man trap, because this is very much like the salt vampire, where, again, it's the last of its kind. Should you kill it or should you not? And what do you guys see as the difference here? Because I think that it was definitely, in both cases, a creature is attacking the crew. And in both cases, the creature is doing it not simply to be malicious, but for a reason that's important to that creature, for its survival.
Maybe the salt vampire... We don't feel bad for it because it's keeping itself alive because it's the last of its kind. But maybe because the Horta is protecting others of its kind. It's not just fighting to survive. It's fighting for the survival of the future of its race. Not, I'm the last one. I deserve to live, blah, blah, blah. It's the Horta's like, I'm the last one. I've got to protect all these guys. And maybe that's the difference. And why we're like, yeah, shoot that salt vampire. And we're like, no, don't hurt the Horta.
Yeah, but before we find that out, they believe that the Horta is the only one of its kind, which means it's doomed to extinction no matter what they do then, because it has nothing to mate with.
Yeah, but if it's a silicon life, they don't know. We don't know how it mates or anything. Theoretically, it could
just
split into two, and now we've got two Hordas. And
that's entirely possible. Yeah, good consideration.
Also, before we find out that as well, Drew, and they're having the debate, and Spock, I really doesn't want the Horta to be killed. You know, don't harm the eggs, and he says that it would be a crime against science if this Horta dies. But I don't recall Spock ever feeling it would be a crime against science if the salt vampire were to die.
Hmm. Maybe because the salt vampire was carbon based.
And those are a dime a dozen. So.
We've got plenty. Dime a dozen. Yeah, we got plenty of carbon based things. Silicon, on the other hand.
Yeah. You know,
we don't understand that.
Ripples on your nose, pointy ears, suction cups on your fingers. You know, it's all kind of the same thing, right?
Yeah, but living rock, that's kind of cool. We should collect that specimen.
Yeah. We need to preserve that.
That's right. All right. Well, so anything else on the mind melds? We pretty much covered that. It's interesting. You know, I wonder, you brought up Nomad, Drew, which is something I was thinking about, that this opens the door. Like, the mind meld is a bit crazy here. And like you mentioned, A Taste of Armageddon before that, where he can do it through the wall and stuff. And then it starts to kind of settle in a little bit, I guess. I mean, he does mind meld with the space probe, but it starts to become less of a magical thing, I guess, mm-hmm. as time goes on in Star Trek, and it becomes a more of a specific ability. You've got to, you know, put your fingers in just the right place. And I think we talked about this last week when we talked about Kirshara, about how, you know, you got to be careful. Like, it's very specific how you mind meld. You know, you don't want to poke anyone in the eye. You don't want to, you know, bruise the nose. And if you don't get your fingers in exactly the right spot, someone could get Pinar syndrome. And here it's just, yeah, you just walk up and you just put your hands out and you start feeling things. And it's kind of all sorts of stuff that goes on here. But this does set up, of course, later on. I wonder if in Star Trek IV, would Spock have mind melded with Gracie if he had never mind melded with the Horta? And also, missed opportunity here in Star Trek IV. Here Spock is mind melding with the Horta, and he's announcing everything that the Horta is thinking. Star Trek IV, they should have had Spock mind melding with Gracie, and he's screaming out whale song, making whale noises. Like, he can't translate it, but he's sharing it with you.
That would be interesting.
And it would be underwater, so it would sound even cooler. And that's how he figures it out, you know, on the ship. So yeah, missed opportunity.
Yes.
Okay, so last item here as we move towards the end, and this isn't really addressed in the episode, but I always think about it because, you know, we have cases on The Next Generation where we talk about slavery and life forms that are intelligent but are very different from us. You know, you think about the exocomps, for example, and using those. Here, Kirk proposes that this is a great solution for the miners because they can use the Horta to increase their mining capacity and their efficiency 1,000 times because all these Horta are going to hatch. And they love to tunnel. It's going to be like the perfect situation here. And Kirk himself talks about reaching an agreement that's going to be beneficial to everyone. But given how these miners reacted to the Horta initially, I mean, do we trust these miners in the long run to not start abusing the Horta?
Well, I imagine the agreement, yeah, the Horta is going to dig through rock anyway. He's going to make tunnels because it's how he gets around. I mean, what are you going to offer him? Hey, if you don't eat that uranium, you know, we'll I don't know what, let you tunnel more? I mean, it sounds like, look, you bring this uranium back to us or we'll kill you is more than likely. We've got our phasers set to silicon and we'll blast you apart.
Yeah. So
that's where I'm seeing they're going.
I think it's more, we're in agreement here that this is going to work as long as it works for us.
Would that really be feasible, though? I mean, with 50,000 or however millions of Horta, I guess there was, yeah, thousands and millions. Would that even make sense? Because there are way too many Horta for them to shoot at. Like, they would be overrun instantly if it was like a threatening situation.
Oh, okay. I guess that makes sense.
I wonder if the Horta scatter throughout the world, and then that way they're not all digging through the same area
right.
of the planet.
Yeah. Can you imagine how many cave-ins there would be? I mean, right. if they See? All stayed yeah. in the same area, you would just, it would be a hollow planet, and then what?
I mean, we're dealing with issues of fracking on Earth right now. Could you imagine what all these Horta in one concentrated area would be doing? Yikes!
Yeah, that's something we forget about this, right? That they're on an entire planet, and we just think about the caves in the episode. But yeah, a million Horda scattered all over the planet, I mean, that would be a very light population all around. You think there are almost 7 billion of us right now on this planet, and we're only talking about a million Horda.
I'd say it's doable. Yeah,
if it's Earth-sized, I mean, a lot of the planets in Star Trek are, you know, like there's 100,000 people on this planet. And, I mean, are there only like that many people in this little bitty area? And it's hard to tell.
Well, planets cannot get much smaller than Earth, I think, and sustain life. Because if you look at Mars, you know, Mars once had a thick atmosphere, but it lost its atmosphere because it's a small planet. You know, Earth, Mars is considerably smaller than Earth. And I think Earth is on, again, I'm not a scientist, but I read about this a lot over the years. And I think Earth is on the smaller end of what is feasible of maintaining an environment that would support life.
Just to rebuttal that a little bit, though, because that generator or whatever actually made the air and the heat. They said they wouldn't have any heat or air. So it's possible that it was a smaller planet and whatever environmental controls they have.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. But even if it's small, let's say it's the size of the moon. I mean, if you scatter a million Horda around that space too, yeah, it could work. So, but back to the real point here. Yeah, I don't know, because I was exactly what you guys said. I was thinking, like, what do we have to offer the Horda? Because they're going to tunnel anyway. So what kind of agreement are we talking about here?
We leave them alone. That's it.
So we just
maybe they import other rocks. Like maybe they're just like they bring in a bunch of different rocks from different planets and find which ones taste better, maybe.
Right. Hmm. Oh, that's a good idea.
Does this taste good? I mean, you like this? We'll get you a lot more of this.
Yeah, okay. This could work because isn't this planet very largely it kind of a processing unit to convert energy?
It is, yeah.
Produce all that. So they're probably getting all sorts of stuff from all sorts of places. And yeah, maybe they could give the Horda a little something they've never had before.
I mean, there's no money in the future, so they don't need gold. So maybe they just feed it, you know, like gold dust. And
they could have like,
you never know,
illegal Romulan quartz or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Vulcan limestone.
Oh, yeah. Vulcan limestone is illegal on Janus 6, right? You have to smuggle that in.
Yeah.
But the Horda really so you do it.
Yeah. I like this idea, Drew. It's kind of like, let's say, sushi. It's like, here, we'll give you the day-old stuff, but, you know, if you tunnel for us really well, we'll get you really fresh stuff from the best restaurant
really
around.
Fresh rocks.
Fresh rocks.
I like it.
I mean, as old as rocks are, I mean, if they find a newly formed planet, maybe rocks can be fresh if you eat rocks.
See, that's what they should have done with the Genesis planet. That's as new as a planet can get. It's as smooth as a baby's bottom. So, missed opportunity there.
Yeah, poor Hordas.
Yeah. You know, you're asking what we could offer them. I was actually looking on Memory Alpha at the Horda page yesterday. And they said that there was supposed to be a Horda crew member on the animated series. And
really? That. Yeah.
Which was kind of interesting.
How would
so maybe
that
it's
have
like
gone?
An exchange program.
We can send Horda to Starfleet Academy.
Exactly.
It could be. I'd like to see the uniform that they make for the Horda and what it's made of.
Yeah.
It's a tablecloth or something.
And, like, do you have to have a Vulcan around, like, riding him while mind-melding him and reading his thoughts to everybody?
Exactly.
I just have the visual of the Horda in a Starfleet uniform crawling across the bridge, climbing up the chair to its station, and I don't know how it presses the buttons.
Just leans on the buttons.
Actually, the Horda page also mentioned that in some novels, some non-canon novels, that there were actually entire... Starfleet vessels only piloted by Horta, and that were just filled with rocks, so they could all just travel throughout the ships and stuff.
I am so glad you brought this up. This explains, in yesterday's Enterprise, why there are rocks on the bridge of the Enterprise.
Oh my god, they had a Horta crew.
Because
in
member. The alternate timeline, they have Horta crew members who need to eat the rocks.
That's right.
Thank you, Daniel.
I'll be darned. That explains
We've
so
solved
much.
It. Great mystery solved here.
And it makes total sense why they're in the ceiling, because if the Horta's going to dig down to go to the next level down, they can just eat the rocks on the way.
Yeah.
Hey.
Very good. One last point here, Drew. I have a question, though. Now, are rocks, mm-hmm. are they like sushi or are they like wine? Are the fresh rocks tastier than the old rocks, or are the old rocks tastier than the fresh rocks?
Maybe it's the reverse.
Yeah, maybe it's the rocks that have aged for a few million years.
Kind of like wine.
You know, they get the nice flavor.
That's right.
Nice rocky flavor.
That makes more sense.
You're like, wow, this is a Alpha Centauri vintage 1642. Very tasty.
Ooh, with fossil bits.
Yeah. It's always better with fossil bits.
Now it sounds like cat food.
All right, guys. Ooh, well, this has been a great discussion. Why don't we wrap up with final thoughts on The Devil in the Dark? Landry, why don't you start us off? Anything else that you want to talk about here?
Devil in the Dark is one of these first season episodes that really shows what Star Trek was supposed to be and what it was supposed to be about and what it is about. Taking an issue and making you think about it, using sci-fi as a trapping. It's an anthology show with standing sets is what Roddenberry was trying to make. So we didn't care about continuity or anything. So here we've got a story that could be at home in a Twilight Zone or an Outer Limits. And they took the concept and made it Star Trek with the Vulcans and the mind melds and the phasers and all the stuff. And I think it's a great balance. It's got some humor in it. It stops and makes you think, and it makes you want to change your point of view and look at things from other people's perspectives. And I think that it's really good. And I would give it 7 million silicon modules.
Excellent. How about you, Char?
Well, I think there's two very important lessons to get out of this episode. The first we talked about quite a bit, things about what is life, keep your mind open. Life is everywhere and probably not in ways you can even perceive. The other, just as important, is do not F with a mother's babies. She will F with you 10 times harder. Both very important life lessons to have, no matter what kind of a life form you are. So that those qualities or those lessons really save this episode for me, because at first it comes across kind of as a mystery. Like, why is the Horta just needlessly killing everything? Well, it's because of the eggs, and that's pretty obvious by the way Spock treats it in the earlier acts. And, well, that's not much of a mystery. It's pretty easy to put together. So easy a cave eater could do it or something. Anyway. So, yeah, that kind of does it for me. It redeems itself, which is good. Otherwise, this is not exactly TOS's best outing. It's pretty campy. A lot of red shirts die, there's caves, all the ingredients, either for a really good or a really bad episode, depending on your point of view. I'm going to give it four pretty silicon bowling ball-shaped eggs.
Very good. And how about you, Daniel?
I enjoy this episode. I the Horta is one of those classic TOS aliens, like... When you think of TOS, she pops in your mind sometimes. And it's something we didn't mention, but something that's really strong in this episode is the interplay between Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And Kirk and Spock, definitely.
Yes.
Which we didn't get to touch on, but really good stuff there. So I really enjoyed that. And yeah, there are some tropes and there's some story elements you kind of have to excuse, but you get the bigger picture, which is more important in this kind of episode. And, you see the message that they're trying to tell. And you have fun on the way, I think. So I really enjoyed the episode. I would probably give it 8. You're really bold, but you're probably not going to end up hurting the Horta pointless clubs.
Great rating. It's good you mentioned, Daniel, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy here, because one other thing that I was going to mention that I didn't was just that they do a really good job in this episode of having that trifecta have different opinions about how they should handle the Horda. You know, Spock wants to kill it at first for some reason, but then he doesn't, but then he does, and then Kirk does, and then he doesn't, and then McCoy just thinks they're crazy because it's rock, and why should I have to heal it in the first place? But then, you know, they all come together, but they just take these three main crew members and they're able to give us three different viewpoints of the situation, even though that changes, kind of flips back and forth. So I thought that was really, really well done. And I'm the same. I know what you mean, Char, about the episode being, it is campy. It is. But, you know, that's one of the charms of TOS is that it's campy. I think in the end, as we mentioned at the beginning, this episode does a really good job of delivering what Star Trek is supposed to do and what the original series does, which is, you know, it picks an important topic about our society and it gives us a message, but it does it not as heavy-handed as it sometimes does, again, with the racial thing. Let That Be Your Last Battlefield is about as heavy-handed as you can possibly get. Here it puts it in, you know, a nice sci-fi wrapping that I think it's easier for us to watch and think about and not feel like we're being preached to as much. So that's really nice. One thing that I should point out here, we know from These Are the Voyages that Riker likes to watch old episodes of Star Trek on the holodeck as he does research. And he did that here too. I don't know if you guys picked up on this, but there's the line, "I could phaser you out." That's actually number 89 in Riker's book of pickup lines. And he got that from watching The Devil in the Dark in the holodeck. So that's something to remember from this episode. But I love this episode myself. It's just good TOS, I think. And the campiness actually adds to it for me. So I'm going to give this episode 8 magenta jumpsuits.
Nice.
All right. Well, Char, before we go, tell everyone where they can find you around the internets and Trek FM.
All right. You can, of course, find me with Tristan Riddell and Laurie Sears on To the Journey.
To the Journey.
To the Journey.
Yay. Yes, we just recorded tonight, so I'm on a To the Journey high. Excellent. Fantastic stuff. Anyway, you can also find me writing a couple things here and there on Trek FM. I don't do that quite as much as I used to because I am now busy editing other people's work, but I'm still omnipresent. I am everywhere, like Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
You can also find me on Twitter, and my handle is OhTheProfanity. It's said with much more pain than I gave it credit for this time.
Great. Landry, where can people find you?
They could find me on Twitter at 005, DOUBLEOFIVE. Write me, tell me that you love me, and
he needs a self-esteem booster.
Maybe. you can find me guest starring on other podcasts such as Commentary Trek Stars and Trek News and Views. Yes,
recording one of those. And you were even on The Orb not too long ago as well.
I was on The Orb. I'm really proud of that, talking about Deep Space Nine Season 1. And what it's like to come into it expecting the greatest television show known to man and getting a Move Along Home.
And I'm a ring.
You have to hang in there. All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining us today, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, Chris. Well, it was good fun to talk to Char and Drew about some original series. It's a series that I don't often watch. It's kind of forgotten about in my mind a lot of times just because it's so far separated from the rest of them, you know, chronologically speaking anyways. So it's good to go back and see where it all began.
Yeah, and remember those episodes. I watch TOS less these days than I used to. Of course, growing up, I grew up with it in the 70s, and I've, over the years, probably all the way into university, I watched lots and lots of TOS, like every day, TOS, TOS, TOS. And these days I watch it less, but, you know, I watch a few episodes every week still because it's classic, you know, That's where it all started. So I love it. And great that we could talk about it today. But you know, this isn't the only thing we've been talking about this week on Trek FM. So here are some other things that you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
The Mirror Universe.
I think that Sisko got, I mean, he went to that universe. He was like, it's been a while. I've always wanted to sleep with Dax. Here we go.
The Ready Room.
Kirshara.
We never got to see what it looked like from McCoy's point of view, to have Spock's Katra within it rattling around in his brain. And I think it was at least cool to see from Archer's point of view, having a Vulcan philosopher, sharing brain space with him and kind of interrupting his day with if inspirational screensavers.
Decade.
Battleship Royal Rumble.
As any contest, it gets harder as it goes on, and so it was reasonably easy to start with, but I don't think, you know, the ship Tom decided to come in was very good.
To the journey!
Star Trek Las Vegas recap.
And that might have been when he bought his costume, because he came up later for another panel with William Shatner and Kate Mulgrew in a captain's uniform TOS style. I'm not saying it happened, I'm just thinking.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Bid time return.
I'm going to hypnotize myself. This seems like a reasonable method. I mean, that to me is almost like someone saying, like watching Back to the Future and saying, like, yeah, I'm going to build a time machine out of a DeLorean.
Warp 5.
Directing Enterprise with Robert Duncan McNeil.
They slipped and started sliding down like a slide, and it was very hard for us to figure out how to film that. And ultimately, we ended up putting a bunch of dirt on the floor and turning the camera sideways and dragging them across the floor. So all those real tight shots of them sliding down is really just them lying on the stage floor and being dragged 50 feet.
Trek News and Views.
Someone to watch over me.
The worst thing about the 7 of 9 Chakotay romance is Jerry Ryan and Robert Beltram actually asked them, do you want us to do this in a romantic way as it's leading somewhere? And they said to him, no, there's no way you two would ever work as a couple.
Literary Treks.
From History's Shadow.
Well, like particularly for the UFO lore, for lack of a better term, I really wanted it to be as close as I could get to being right on. But, you know, obviously I had to make some concessions for the Star Trek take on certain events.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all these shows. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week. Some days we even have two shows, and you'll find them in iTunes, on Stitcher, TuneIn, the Windows Podcast Directory for Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. You can stream them from the website. You can download files from the website. You have many, many places where you can get the shows. So give us a listen and get your Trek on every day. Now, Daniel, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on The Devil in the Dark or anything else that we talked about in news today, and of course, where they can send in their questions for Questions from the Fleet. That's at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Just choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. If you'd like to talk to other listeners and the broader Trek FM crew, you can do that on our forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for the Ready Room, one for each different series and various other topics. So go over there and join in the bigger conversation. If you'd like to send us a voicemail, and we'd love for you to do that, we'd love to hear your voice, you can look on the right-hand side of any page on the website, and you'll see a tab there that says Send Voicemail. Just choose that, and a box will pop up. You can use your webcam's microphone to record the message, and you can upload it to us as an MP3 file from the page. And in social media, you'll find us at facebook.com/trekfm, and you'll always find us tweeting away about Star Trek on Twitter all the time under username trekfm. Now, Daniel, what if people would like to look you up personally? Where should they go?
Well, here on the network, I'm occasionally here on the Ready Room. Elsewhere, social media, general, Twitter, Facebook, Google+. My account name is 1UpDan, and that is the number one. Not the letter, where you can often find me talking about Star Trek, about anything nerdy, often tweeting about video games, anything you want to talk about, you can hit me up and we can have a conversation.
Yeah, I think 1UpDan is, you started that right after your last appearance on the Ready Room, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I did. I was, my old username was my last name, and kind of a pain to spell. So yeah. I wanted to get something a little simpler, a little cleaner.
So everyone go, if you were following Daniel at the previous account, go over and follow him at the new account as well. It's got a cool little one-up mushroom there, so we know that he's always got an extra life no matter what goes wrong.
That's me.
And if you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is CBrianJones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username. You'll also find my personal website under that name as well, CBrianJones.com. And I talk about non-Star Trek things over there, but also that capsule review of Into Darkness that I mentioned during news is there. So if you'd like to read that, you can find that as well. I believe CBrianJones.com/Star Trek will take you right into that page, and there might be a hyphen there between Star and Trek, but that's over there. Elsewhere on the network, you'll find me on Sundays with Matthew Rushing on Literary Treks, where we talk about Star Trek books and comics and interview authors. And you'll find me on Mondays with Matthew again on The Orb, where we talk about Deep Space Nine, and on Fridays with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where we talk about Enterprise and interview people involved in the creation of the show as well. This past week, we actually sat down with Robbie Duncan McNeil and talked about the 4 episodes that he directed. And we talk a bit about Voyager in that one as well, and kind of general Star Trek and television. So go check that out if you're a fan of Robbie. Also, while we're talking about shows and iTunes and all that stuff, we had a couple of reviews left in iTunes this past week as well. So we want to say thank you to TheFace022 and Captain Koloth for their reviews of The Ready Room. And we really appreciate that. Captain Koloth said we're simply the best out there. And if you love Star Trek, this is a show that is absolutely not to be missed. So that's really nice. We're glad that you feel that way about the show. We just do our best every week to have fun talking about Star Trek, and hopefully everyone enjoys the show. So if you do, please drop by iTunes and leave us a review. It only takes about 30 seconds to leave a written review and a star rating, and that really does help Star Trek fans find the show when they search iTunes for Star Trek podcasts, especially since we don't have Star Trek in the name of our show. So thank you guys for those reviews.
Yeah, Captain Koloth sounds like a really nice Klingon.
He is a nice Klingon. He left a nice review of The Orb as well. Matthew and I were very relieved that he wasn't going to be coming after us with the Bat'leth. And we gave Jadzia permission to go off and hunt down the albino with Captain Koloth anytime she wants. Also, before we go, Daniel, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsors for this week's show. Again, your support of our sponsors is very important to making it possible for us to bring The Ready Room and all the other programming on Trek FM to you every week. First, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, online store, as we discussed, or really anything you can imagine. Create your own space today. I promise you're going to love it. Go to squarespace.com for your free 14-day trial and then use offer code TREK8 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts and choose that annual plan to get that free custom domain registration. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of The Ready Room and Trek FM. And also, please visit trekfan.org. It's a great chance for you to come together with other fans to collaborate and solve puzzles and real-life mission objectives. And along the way, you can win great prizes. So turn your love for Star Trek into something that can help us all move toward that future we love. Support us and support TrekFan by visiting trekfan.org, solve that first puzzle, and take the next step on your adventure. And we really thank TrekFan for their support of The Ready Room as well. And lastly, if you would personally like to support the network and our programming, there's a way for you to do that as well. If you go over to trek.fm/donate, you'll find 8 alien-themed badges and art prints. And these are done by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. You can mix and match what you want, badges and art prints. There are different levels of donations that you can make. And your contributions help us cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring this programming to you every week. So we really thank you for your support of Trek FM. Go over to trek.fm/donate and pick your alien badges and art prints. All right, Daniel. Well, I'm going to wander off. I'm going to go down to level 23, which, of course, as you know, is also known as Checkpoint Tiger. And, you know, see if I can meet up with Kirk and get an update on the Horda hunt.
All right, well, good luck with that, Chris, because it's time to stick some thermal concrete in it because the Ready Room is done.
Yeah.
And they're not just saying Phaser 1 or Phaser 2. They're saying number 1 or number 2. And I'm kind of giggling through the whole thing because I'm immature like that.
You better take this number 1.
Number 1, I order you to take a number 2.
Well, that's where Kirk lines everyone up and he says, look, if you're set to number 1, feel free to go anywhere in the caves. If you're set to number 2, please go to the vault of yesterday.
Yeah, pretty much.